30,000 people marched in the streets of San Francisco on Saturday to rise for climate, jobs, and justice. Among them, our next guest, Dr. Mustafa Santiago Ali. He's the Senior Vice President of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization for the Hip Hop Caucus, a national organization that connects the hip hop community to the civic process. In March 2017, he resigned from the EPA, where he had served for 24 years, having founded its Office of Environmental Justice. He wrote a lengthy resignation letter to then EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. While at the EPA, he served as the Assistant Associate Administrator for Environmental Justice and Senior Advisor for Environmental Justice and Community Revitalization. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I know you're here for the series of climate actions taking place around and in response to Governor Jerry Brown's Global Climate Action Summit. And we're going to talk about your Our Village events that the Hip Hop Caucus is hosting with others here this week. But let's start with the news. We've got a hurricane headed towards North Carolina, South Carolina, Hurricane Florence. Can you talk, let's just start with talking about what that means for environmental justice.
Oh, sure. You know, it's unfortunate that we have not paid enough attention to frontline communities and the impacts that come. For decades, environmental justice leaders have been asking people to pay attention to these fossil fuel facilities that are located inside of their communities, and that they often get a double whammy. And what's about to happen is a great example of that. The first one happens from the pollution that continues to come out of these plants and the public health impacts that happen inside of those communities. Then we all know that, or at least 97% of the folks inside of our country know that, you know, that the fossil fuels, greenhouse gases are warming up our planet and increasing these storms like Hurricane Florence, which is now about to hit the coast. Folks have a very difficult time then in being able to escape and being able to deal with the impacts and then being able to come back home and recover and rebuild. And when we talk about environmental justice communities, we are talking about communities of color. We're talking about low-income communities, many instances, lower-income and working-class white communities, and we are talking about indigenous populations. I've been on the phone with folks in North Carolina and South Carolina trying to help to marshal resources for folks to be able to escape, because unfortunately, still in our emergency planning, and I did a number, worked a number of different unfortunate incidences in my time working inside of the federal government, we forget that there are those who don't often have the ability to be able to escape. And they are also impacted by a number of toxic sites. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, let's start right there, because one of the things that is, I guess, on the good side for the Atlantic is there is no oil and gas drilling offshore in the Atlantic, at least. So we don't have offshore installations there that could be run over by a storm, pipelines connected to shore. For now, we don't have drilling there. So that's one good sign about the Atlantic. But there's lots of other infrastructure there. So let's talk about what you were worried about the storm hitting.
Well, sure. I mean, sometimes folks don't realize that we have millions of miles of pipeline that does run all across our country. If you saw a map of it, it would be amazing to folks to see that there is this much that exists and that there are proposals to create more. So folks are always worried about breaches that may exist in those pipelines that you know, travel up and down. But let's get more specific about things that people smell and feel and taste on a regular basis. There are a number of Superfund sites that exist in both South Carolina and North Carolina. And we know from previous examples of the impacts that happen. We know that during Hurricane Harvey in Texas, that there were, you know, unfortunately with the flooding, that some of the toxic sites, you know, moved a number of pieces of very, very dangerous chemicals around, ending up in schoolyards, people's backyards, for those who still have wells. And people should realize that there are in rural communities a number of folks who still receive their drinking water from wells. So you have to be very concerned about that also. I hope folks also are paying attention to the certified animal feeding operations. People call those CAFOs. Let's get past the, you know, that technical term and break it down to what it is. In many instances, instances, there are tens of thousands of hogs and other livestock that are located in areas. And you have these lagoons. The lagoons have the waste and all kinds of nasties that are inside of there. So again, when we have these extreme weather events, extreme rains, flooding, these lagoons breach. Move into the water bodies, move into people's well systems. And for those who maybe are still trapped there and get caught in the water, they are also exposed to these pathogens and other sort of toxic nightmares that exist in this situation. And those are just a couple of the examples that folks who are dealing with environmental injustices have to deal with.
Barnwell, South Carolina specifically hosts one of the nation's few radioactive waste dumps.
Yes.
Can we talk about kind of which portions of the state are most vulnerable to major storms? So what they're evacuating now are the coastal areas and the outlying islands. Who lives there?
Well, there are a number of folks who live there. So, you know, you find an interesting dynamic. I've spent a huge amount of time in the South and in the Mid-Atlantic over the years. So you find that there are, in certain areas, of course, wealthier folks who can afford to live on the coast. But you also have a number of African-American and indigenous populations who live there. There are a number of state-recognized tribes and others who are not recognized who are in these areas and have a difficult time. You also have a new and growing Latino population also. And then you have some other new residents into our country who are also in those areas. So, you know, it makes it a very interesting dynamic. One, making sure that the proper language translations are in place to help people to understand what's coming, how to return, the impacts that will be a part of this process are something that folks also have to concern themselves with. And due to this administration, one of the other things that I raised, the Washington Post just put out a story the other day that 1,600 EPA employees have left, either resigned or retired. So I always pose the question, how many of these folks were in the emergency response program there at the agency? I know that, you know, I did that for a few times. So also, will we have the folks in place to be able to help as folks are moving into these situations? Of course, along with FEMA, everybody knows FEMA, but EPA plays a huge role in these devastations.
I mean, we've done segments before on like the Gullah enclaves in the islands off South Carolina.
Oh, yes.
It's a black population that was so isolated for so much of its history, it developed its own language.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a place that would be hard to evacuate, hard to get emergency services to. If you're starting from that amount of isolation.
Yeah, there actually are a number of islands throughout there, and I'm glad that you raised that. Queen Quet is one of the leaders who's there. You know, the dynamic there is folks have been concerned with rising sea levels there. They've been worried about the eroding culture, and now, of course, we have these storms that are coming, which makes it even more difficult. Many of the folks, of course, have some economic challenges in that space. There have also been some interesting dynamics that have gone on in relation to the government there, local government there, and the relationship there. And I'm glad you raised that because there are also other examples. So most folks should know there at the Gula Islands or the Gullah Islands, depending on how you say it, these were folks in many instances who escaped slavery and founded their own communities and strengthened their culture there. There are also other places like Princeville, North Carolina. Princeville is another one of those freedmen communities. And for the listeners who might not be familiar with that, freedmen communities are communities that were founded by freed slaves who did everything they possibly could to save nickels and dimes and to be able to found their own places where they could be safe. And unfortunately, Princeville is another example of when climate deniers are not thinking properly about how do we help to put the right resources in place to protect these communities. They've had these major floods that have came through. You know, we used to talk about 100-year floods. Now we talk about 500-year and 1,000-year floods. They've been hit a couple of times now. And I tried to get on the line with some folks who were there to see what was going on in that dynamic, to see if folks are able to be able to get away. And, you know, I haven't been successful yet in that space. But that's another example of these communities, hardworking, dedicated folks who for no fault of their own have had a difficult time in being able to move up the economic ladder, to have the resources that are necessary to be able to escape and then rebuild. So it's an interesting dynamic that goes on with many of our communities who are along the eastern shore, eastern coast.
And we're talking with Dr. Mustafa Santiago Ali, Senior Vice President of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization for the Hip Hop Caucus. So one of the things that's happening with Florence is as climate change is intensifying and worsening and changing our weather patterns, we're getting these storms that not just go through, but stay. Mm-hmm. And like Hurricane Harvey, Florence is being predicted to just stay in place and not move and dump enormous amounts of water onto these communities. And we also know that burning fossil fuels is the cause of worsening climate change. But right now, we just learned that the EPA is planning to roll back, among hundreds of rules of the Obama administration that have been rolled back, a methane regulation that may come as early as this week. And we know that methane is one of the most climate-destroying gases that we have. Can you talk about what's happening at the EPA about the methane rule and what else we need to have our eyes out for that you're most concerned about with this EPA right now?
Well, I'm concerned with almost everything that the EPA has been doing. Let me say the political leadership at EPA. I want to make sure that I sort of parse that out because there are incredible staff who work there. They take their oath very serious. Let me say that again for folks. You take an oath when you take a job in federal service to protect the country. And at EPA, it's about protecting public health and the environment. What you currently find is there's a trifecta going on. And what I mean by that is there have been three major sort of pieces that the former administration had left behind to address some of these impacts that we're now seeing from climate change. One of those, of course, was a clean power plan. And of course, we know now they had the affordable clean energy. Some people call it the dirty power plan. Some say the dirty power scam. You can decide how you want to sort of label that. But that was one of those dealing with carbon pollution and also some of the co-pollutants, which are some of the greenhouse gases. And, you know, the previous administration was very focused on being able to lower those emissions. That's one part of that trifecta. The second part of the trifecta has been the CARS rule, which makes no sense for someone to try and weaken, you know, the overall mileage that a car gets. So for me, that shows a disconnect between everyday people because most folks want their cars to get better mileage because we don't want to pay the huge amount of money that we have to pay for a gallon of gas. And then also to lower the emissions that are coming out of those tailpipes. So that's the second part. This methane rule is the third part, and there's real concerns for communities that come from an environmental justice background because in many instances, they're looking out at the refineries and others. They are also the folks that are dealing with the fracking issues that are going on across the country. I think at the last count that I had, there are about 300,000 fracking wells that are in our country. So that's amazing that we have that many in place. And, you know, so you what you have with the methane rule is that there are emissions that escape. And the former was to try and tighten down on that, to lessen the amount of greenhouse gases that were escaping, moving into our atmosphere. And as you had rightly said, then intensifying these storms. No one is saying that, you know, whether it's carbon or methane or some of the other co-pollutants, that they're the only thing, but they are definitely a driver in the intensity. And what you find, we can look at Hurricane Harvey. There's no way to escape the facts. Trillions of gallons of water were released during Hurricane Harvey. They're saying that this approaching storm could have a very similar impact. And again, you know, when you are rushing that much water through an area, even a large area, there are going to be huge impacts. There are so many brownfield sites, Superfund sites, and others that are around our country, especially along the East Coast, that this is just going to have huge impacts on that, along with people not being able to escape. Some folks are so anchored to where they live. Their culture is there that, unfortunately, they won't heed the warning and they will stay behind. And that's just one set of examples. You know, there's a greater intensity from the winds that are happening. So the question was posed also, it's not just a coastal issue that we are dealing with. We are also dealing with those winds and that storm that is estimated that might move at least 150 miles inland, you know, all the way up to Raleigh, let's say, which is about, I think, 150 miles away from the coast. And there will be extreme, winds that will impact trees and a number of other things that will come down. Some of the infrastructure that's in place, the dams and other things, will have a very difficult time in being able to deal with the water impacts that are going to be moving forward. So there are a number of things that are connected to the methane rule and to the other ones we mentioned.
And these are also policies. I mean, the thing with the methane rule, this is really just about requiring the companies tighten places where methane is leaking from pipelines, from production sites, from refineries, from places where natural gas is brought into homes. And it's just an expense of tightening what they're already doing. That's all the methane rule is. It's the same with the car exhaust. Again, it's just an expense in making cars more efficient and more fuel efficient. These aren't mysterious, concepts. Do we agree with it? Do we not? We agree with it. It's just whether we're willing to have the industry incur the cost or not of rules that make very good sense and that we know will reduce the intensity of these storms, which more and more and more people across the country and across the world are being exposed to. Mm-hmm. So in talking about this politics, which you've been very much in the middle of, right now we're in the midst of this discussion with Governor Brown. One of the demands of the Rise for Climate movement has been that the governor take leadership on even moving one step further than regulations, but rather the keeping fossil fuels in the ground as a show of leadership, that this is a place where that can start happening. Can you talk about the politics of these, trying to get these different type of policies moving?
Well, there is an interesting dynamic that goes on. It is really a very clear, placing profit over people. And now the dynamic of trying to find common sense sort of initiatives to be able to move forward. So at GCAS, the Global Climate
Action Summit
is an opportunity for leaders from all across the world, along with frontline communities and others, to begin to move forward on these common sense initiatives, and hopefully more than that, than just the basics of being able to find ways of, lowering the emissions that are happening. It's focused on innovation. So there will be a number of businesses and industries who will be sharing also. And I raise that because they can also help to be a driver in the politics in helping to move some of these politicians to do the right thing, both on the state level and the federal level and on the international level. Because in many instances, some of these businesses or these conglomerates will be making some announcements about some of the actions that they are planning on doing and moving forward. And I think that has to be a part of the equation, because you will always hear people talk about, especially in the political sense, of jobs versus the environment, which is a false narrative. That paradigm has been reworked a long time ago. When we took lead out of gasoline, they said the economy would crash. It wasn't true. When we, dealt with some of the issues that we're dealing in the atmosphere and being able to still continue to move forward and make and people still make profit, those types of things. So this political conversation is really tied to our vote. And folks should utilize their vote. I never tell folks who to vote for, but you should vote for someone who cares about your community, cares about the future of your children, so forth and so on. And that's the other sort of dynamic that will go into not only the set of actions, but also having folks on Capitol Hill and in other offices that care about what's happening.
So the focus of this week's actions, the demonstrations, has been pressuring California state government to take more aggressive climate action than it is. I'm curious, you were inside EPA for more than two decades. Mm-hmm. When a state goes above and beyond the feds on environmental regulations, what kind of political effect does that have inside the agency? Is there like a trickle-up pressure?
I think it does. And I think that it also helps people to be able to have something, a guiding, a North Star, if you will.
Lone Star.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it would be great if the Lone Star would focus on the North Star. It was always interesting. California was always that was ahead of the curve, if you will. And others would try to emulate and to try to figure out how do we get to where they are, showing us that it is quite possible. So I think that it is a positive. But I would like to see other states actually leap ahead of the, you know, the great work that is happening here in California. Now, let me just preface that by saying that there are still some real challenges that exist here in California. And that's one of the reasons that so many grassroots leaders have also, you know, raised why we march. Well, why we march is because they want to make sure that Governor Brown doesn't move forward on any more oil and lease, things in that space. So that's important also. And, you know, I appreciate the positive things that Governor Brown has done, SB, you know, 100, and some of the other actions that he has the opportunity to show real leadership. But there are communities who are here in California that are still suffering and are dealing with the impacts from oil and gas. And I hope that he will continue to live up to the mantle of being a true leader.
And one of the spaces that you've, Hip Hop Caucus has created is called Our Village, bringing Indigenous peoples, communities of color, and grassroots voices to the forefront of the Global Climate Action Summit. Can you tell us briefly, we only have a few seconds, mm-hmm. how people can find out more and what Our Village is all about?
Oh, Our Village is an opportunity for artists and entertainers, policymakers, young leaders, Indigenous leaders, both domestically and internationally, are all coming together into that space. We're going to have, you know, poets and singers. We're going to have some of the most incredible panels. We have over 20 different events that are happening. And we're blessed that, you know, we partner with If Not Us, Then Who? And we're going to be at 981 Mission Street, right there on the corner of 6th and Mission, there at the Covo Center. So we're hoping everyone will come out. And then also in solidarity with the incredible work you guys are doing here, we also have the coolest show on climate change.
Oh, yeah.
Think 100% with Antonique Smith, the incredible artist and actress, along with Reverend Yearwood and myself. And this show that we're going to be doing is on women in the environment. Grassroots leaders, young leaders from This Is Zero Hour, policy folks. So we're excited to be in that space. And then we're partnering with Grist also for an incredible reception. If you all want to make science sexy and really understand how culture plays a role in helping us to win on climate change, you definitely want to come out for the 3+ days of content that we have going on.
I don't know about making it sexy, but I'd settle for making science inform policy-making decisions. Mustafa Santiago Ali, yes. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you all so much. And thank you for this incredible show and the work you guys do. It's so necessary and so needed at this time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's Mustafa Santiago Ali. He is now Senior Vice President of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization with the Hip Hop Caucus, formerly founded the Environmental Justice Office inside the EPA, ran it for more than 2 decades, resigned after Donald Trump took office.